Chapter 49.
My name is Prophet.
Lulu has laid down his weatherby and put his hands in the air as instructed. The flame on the kerosene lantern has been turned up, and in the light he can see all those gathered in the cabin. Most of them are native. The man looking nearly dead on the bunk is Lou Morisot. In preparation for Kimball's mission, Lulu memorized the faces of both the man and his wife. The young woman sitting with him is Belle Morisot, and the man who opened the door is her brother Anton. Lulu was shown their photographs at the home in Bina. The white man who ordered him to lay down his weapon is, he guesses, the Mide woman's husband, Cork. The young man, who clearly has native blood in him, must be O'Connor's son, Stephen. "You're the one from the woods," O'Connor says.
"One of them,"
Lulu acknowledges. "My wife tells me you're a different man now," O'Connor says skeptically.
"This time I'm here to help. You've been tracked."
"We know," Anton Morisot says. Lulu looks at the man on the bed.
"The Cherokee out front. Yours?"
Lou Morisot nods.
"Then the rest of you must have come by boat?"
None of them offer a reply, but Lulu understands. Why should they trust him?
"The man who's tracked you here is named Kimball. If he finds you, he'll make certain that no one else does, ever. That's after he's gotten from you whatever it is you have that he wants. Then he'll erase every bit of evidence that he was ever here and that you were ever here."
"People on the island know we're here," Belle says.
"And who will listen to them?"
Lulu says.
"Governments, all of them, make people disappear. How long does the echo of those who go missing last? It doesn't matter that anyone knows you're here. What matters is that no one will be able to discover where you've gone. You need to go before Kimball and his people come here looking for you."
"They don't know about the cabin," Belle says.
"I wouldn't count on that."
It's O'Connor's son who speaks.
"Tanya."
Whoever that is, Lulu can see that it's a name with a profound and dark impact.
"You need to take the jeep and get away now."
"No keys,"
Lou Morisot says in a dead voice.
"Then we'll take my vehicle,"
Lulu says. O'Connor hesitates, studies Lulu's face, their eyes meeting for a long moment. Then he nods. "Let's go."
"Help me, Anton,"
Belle says. Together she and her brother help Lou to stand. He nearly crumples when he tries to put weight on his wounded, infected leg, but the strength of the others keeps him from falling. They hobble together toward the door.
"Okay if I get my rifle?"
Lulu asks. O'Connor nods. "Take it."
"My satchel,"
Lou Morisot says. Stephen grabs it as they pass the table. O'Connor opens the door and gestures for Lulu to go first. The others follow him into the gathering dark. They're halfway to Lulu's SUV when two sets of headlights appear 100 yards down the track through the woods.
"Edgar,"
Belle says hopefully.
"Those are xenon headlights,"
Lulu says.
"I'm guessing not standard equipment for any vehicles on the reserve. It's Kimball."
"What do we do?" Belle asks.
"You take the boat, all of you,"
Lulu replies.
"I'll hold them off."
"If we stick together, we might be able to hold them off," Anton Morisot says.
Lulu shakes his head. "If you stay, people will die. Take the boat, and the outcome will be different."
"What about you?" Belle says.
"I've dealt with Kimball before. I'll handle him."
"How do we know we can trust you?" Stephen O'Connor says.
Your friend Henry Malou would ask, "What does your heart tell you?"
In the looming dark, the older O'Connor studies Lalou. "Miigwech," he finally offers.
"Take my briefcase, Prophet,"
Lou Morisot says.
"It's what they're after."
"No, Lou," Bell says.
"Everything in there is on the thumb drive. Maybe if this Kimball gets what he wants, he won't do anything drastic."
"You don't know, Kimball," Lalou says, "but maybe it will buy you more time."
He takes a satchel, then watches as the others disappear around the side of the cabin, heading through the birch trees toward the lakeshore. He returns alone to the cabin, sets the satchel on the table, and lowers the flame of the kerosene lantern to a bare flicker. He stands at the front window as the headlights near. He doesn't fear this confrontation with his former commander. There is a calm inside him more profound than any he has ever known. The path he is on, he understands, is the path that was always meant for him, and it will take him where he was always meant to be. The SUVs pull up behind Lou Morisot's Cherokee, and the SUV Lalou came in, blocking any hope of escape. The doors open, and four men exit from each of the vehicles, eight in all, armed with rifles. They wear dark-shaded clothing, prepared to blend into the night. Lalou is dressed in the camo he wore in the Boundary Waters days ago. He can smell the faint aroma of the smoke from the last campfire, the one he shared with the two Midays, and there is comfort in that primal scent. He watches the operatives spread out, flanking the sides of the cabin, covering any escape he might attempt. Those who remain in front of the cabin use the Cherokee as cover. It's clear that Kimball is preparing for a firefight. "You inside the cabin. Lou Morisot, this is the police. Come out with your hands up." It's Kimball's voice. Lalou makes no reply. Time is what he's playing for here. "We know you're in there, Morisot. Come out, or we'll use force to bring you out." Lalou slips to a side window, sees that one of the operatives there is working his way toward the cabin. He fires a shot through the window, aimed not to kill, just to warn. Then he moves to the window on the other side and does the same. There's no return fire. Lalou understands that Kimball doesn't want to take any chances killing Lou Morisot before the man has given him what he came for. "All we want are the papers. Hand them over, and we'll leave here quietly." Lalou thinks about one of the missions Kimball recruited him for in Colombia years ago. After FARC demobilized, a remnant group had taken a Canadian nun hostage for ransom, and Kimball brought in Lalou to find her and her captors. It was the dry season, and Lalou had no trouble tracking the group to a small compound, a collection of shacks, really, on the bank of a river backwater near the border with Venezuela. Kimball and the team had entered the compound at night and extracted the woman without firing a shot. As soon as she was safely away, however, Kimball commenced a firefight that decimated the small group of former guerrillas. Lalou hadn't participated in that part of the operation. Tracking was all he'd been hired to do. But he'd led Kimball there, and although the guerrillas were not people he particularly cared about, he could see no reason for the slaughter and felt a gnawing sense of responsibility. When he'd questioned Kimball later about the necessity of the killing, the man had replied, "A rabid dog will continue to bite until you kill it, no? How were those people any different?" Lou suspects that to Kimball, Lou Morisot is simply another rabid dog. The shot comes through the front window, showering glass across the wood floor. One shot, that's all. Just a warning, Morisso. There's plenty more where that came from. We're not leaving until we have those papers.
Leloup pitches his voice high.
I've made copies and sent them to the newspapers.
If that's true, then there's no reason not to give us what we've asked for.
I don't have the papers with me.
Fine. Just let us come in and look.
One man, no weapon.
There's a period of quiet. Then Kimball calls back.
Deal.
What's your name?
What does it matter?
Say your name.
Yates.
Leloup smiles. Whenever Kimball uses a pseudonym, he always chooses a poet.
Come ahead, Yates, but only you.
The man leaves the cover of the parked vehicles and walks toward the cabin. It's too dark to see him clearly. If it is Kimball, he will have a weapon on him, maybe a SIG P365 and an ankle holster or a knife tucked somewhere. It will come out the moment Leloup's attention is directed elsewhere.
Stop,
Leloup orders when the man is near the door. He can see now that it isn't Kimball.
Turn around and go back the way you came.
As the man turns to follow the instructions, Leloup calls out,
This time make sure it's you, Yates.
After a minute later, one of the men walks to the cabin. From the way he limps, Leloup is certain that this time it's Kimball.
Open the door and enter.
Kimball steps inside.
Close the door behind you.
When Kimball has complied, Leloup says in his normal voice,
How's the leg?
He can tell by the long pause in responding that he's taken Kimball by surprise, but the man's voice when he answers is as cool as iced tea.
The old man, he somehow flipped you.
He just helped me see who I really am.
In the ghost of illumination, the tiny kerosene flame offers, they eye each other.
And who are you, Leloup?
Prophet.
Of things to come?
Of the next few moments, anyway.
So what now, Prophet?
We wait.
Where is Morisseau gone?
To safety.
There's no such place. If I don't get him, there are others who will.
Not before the world knows the truth, whatever it is.
Kimball gives a bark of a laugh.
You think that will end this? There's far too much at stake.
If the information Lou Morisseau has can be written off so easily, why all the efforts to find him? No, Kimball, I smell fear.
Then we're done here.
Not quite. Why don't you just have a seat?
I believe I'll walk out that door instead.
I don't think so. Remember McHugh?
Shoot me, and it will be in cold blood. Would you do that?
Do you want to take that risk?
You've always been a strange one, Leloup, but something I've always known about you is that you don't really have the heart for killing. Not in cold blood, anyway.
Try to walk out the door, and we'll both find out if that's true.
Kimball's eyes are locked on Leloup's face, as if trying to see through to the man's thoughts. In the next moment, whether he will test Leloup becomes a moot point. The window shatters and something hits the floor. Although Leloup can't see the smoke, he senses the tear gas immediately and covers his face with the crook of his arm. Kimball is already out the door. Leloup has no option but to follow. Outside, he's tackled immediately and bodies pin him to the ground. Blow after blow is delivered to his head until he drops into a black that is very near unconsciousness. But not quite. He can feel himself rolled to his stomach, arms pinned against his back, wrists bound with a plastic restraint.
Get him up, he hears Kimball order. He's hauled to his feet and supported as he finds his footing and his senses return. Someone shines a flashlight into his eyes, blinding him. Behind the light, Kimball speaks. Where is he gone?
I told you. To safety.
The blow comes to his solar plexus, knocking the air out of him, and he struggles to breathe. How'd he get past us?
Just smarter than you, I guess.
Another blow that would double him over if he weren't being held so tight. Whoever you are now, prophet, or just the pathetic remains of a man, it's time you disappeared. Then we'll find Morisseau, and he'll disappear too.
You don't need to go after him. What you're looking for is in the cabin, the satchel on the table.
Kimball leaves and comes back a minute later. Why did he leave this behind?
Because his life is precious to him. And I promised him I would see that you didn't get it.
And yet here it is.
Can't say I didn't try.
We'll still get Morisseau, Kimball says. I don't like loose ends. Bring him. The light swings away from his eyes, and it takes a few moments for Lulu's vision to adjust again to the dark. He's shoved toward the SUVs parked behind the Cherokee. He's always known the end would be death. It's the same for every living thing. But all his life he's believed that his death would mean nothing, and this, more than death itself, is what has always troubled him. But the old Midday finally opened his eyes to the true nature of the journey he's been on his whole life. And if this death is the one that has always awaited him, there is a reason. They are at the vehicles when lights appear on the lane through the woods, a long train of more than a dozen sets of headlights. Truck engines growl like a pack of hungry wolves. The train stops at the edge of the small clearing where the cabin sits on the bank of Fox Creek. The squeals of truck doors opening on hinges is followed by the pop, pop, pop of those doors closing. An army of silhouettes gathers in the glare of the headlights. All we want is profit. Lulu recognizes the voice of Cork O'Connor. He's in our custody, Kimball says.
Custody of who?
This time it's Anton Morisseau who speaks. The authorized representatives of the Crown, Kimball declares.
Bullshit.
This is a voice Lulu doesn't recognize. We are the authorized representatives of the Kekakozabi First Nation Anishinaabeg. You are on sovereign tribal land. Here, we give the orders. There is a sound like 100 castanets tapping nearly in unison. A sound Lulu recognizes as the chambering of rounds and the racking of slugs in dozens of rifles and shotguns. Mr. Authorized Representative of the Crown, it would be a good idea to hand over this man and lay down your weapons. Then you can all go on your way peacefully, the voice says. Lulu has been with Kimball on many missions, both in and out of uniform, and has often seen him act with cruelty rather than necessity. He knows that Kimball hates to lose. The man stands unmoving, his face ice white in the glare of the headlights, and his eyes burning with a silvery fire. Lulu is concerned that the man might still be considering a firefight, one that he can't win, and that may cost the lives of a lot of good people.
Morisseau's gone, Kimball, Lulu says. You've got what you came for. Mission accomplished.
For a long moment, Kimball makes no reply. He studies the large gathering that confronts him, assessing all the firepower they hold. Finally, he says to his men, "Lay down your weapons." Kimball's people comply. Several men from the reserve emerge from behind the headlights and walk among them, collecting the firearms.
"Over here, Prophet," Cork O'Connor says. Although Kimball has ordered his men to disarm, as Lulu walks toward the gathering silhouetted in the headlights, he half expects a bullet in his back. But he crosses the neutral ground without incident, and on the other side, Anton Morisseau cuts the plastic restraint that binds his wrists.
"Tanya," O'Connor calls out, "step into the light." A woman emerges from behind the safety of one of the SUVs and enters the illumination of the headlights. O'Connor pulls his cell phone from his jacket and snaps a picture. "We know that Tanya Baptiste isn't your real name, but no matter," O'Connor says. "We're going to make sure that the photo I just took gets circulated among all the reserves in Canada. Good luck in the future pretending to be anything other than who and what you are." The man who seems to be in charge says to Kimball, "Mr. so-called representative of the Crown, have your people back away from their vehicles." Kimball gives the order.
"Do as he says."
When Kimball and his operatives have distanced themselves, the man in charge says, "The tires, guys. All of them." Several armed men move around the SUVs, putting a bullet in every tire. Then they rejoin the others. "It's probably a good idea to stay here the night," the man in charge says. "You never know what might be waiting for you on these back roads in the dark." The people around Lulu begin to return to their vehicles. Anton Morisseau touches Lulu's arm.
"Come with us, Prophet."
He's led to a truck and gets in with Morisseau and O'Connor. All the vehicles maneuver U-turns, then head back the way they came.
"The others?" Lulu asks. "Your son and Lou Morisseau and his sister?"
"On their way to a hospital the other side of the border," O'Connor tells him. "By the time we returned on the boat, a friend of Anton, a man named Edgar Green, had rallied his people."
"You heard Edgar back there at the cabin," Morisseau says. "He was the one giving Kimball all the grief."
One of Edgar's friends loaned Bell a jeep. "We thought it was best that they get started while we came to give you a hand," O'Connor concludes. Lulu shakes his head.
"Kimball will see to it that they're picked up at the border checkpoint."
"Don't worry," Anton Morisseau assures him. "My brother knows a few unofficial ways to get across." At the junction of Freedom Road, Morisseau pulls to a stop. Another truck draws up and stops beside him. A man gets out and steps to the window Morisseau has lowered.
"Che Miigwech, Edgar,"
Morisseau says. "Haven't felt this pumped in a long time, Anton." Lulu recognizes the voice of the man he now knows as Edgar Green. "This will be a story we'll be telling on the island for a good long while. Thanks, O'Connor, for all you've done. And Prophet, we're in your debt."
"Miigwech means thank you,"
Morisseau tells Lulu.
"And how do you say goodbye?"
Lulu asks.
"There's no word for goodbye in our language,"
Morisseau says.
"The closest we come is Minawa Giga Wabamin. Means see you later." "Minawa Giga Wabamin,"
Lulu says. Edgar Green smiles. "Anton, get your ass in gear before that bunch of jackasses back at Fox Creek decide to try something else." Morisseau starts for the junction of the Trans-Canada Highway and from there toward home in Minnesota. Lulu has been on many missions in the company of many men, but he has never felt the kind of companionship that overwhelms him in this moment. As they rumble along Freedom Road with the dark woods embracing them on all sides and the eyes of countless stars watching them from above, He whispers to all the spirits that he understands surround them.
Miigwech.
To which O'Connor adds quietly, Amen.